Dan McTague was first elected to Parliament in 1993 with the defeat of Rennie Sutton's in the old Ontario riding, and then later Pickering Scarborough East. Dan had worked for a couple of MPs before going to work with Toyota Canada, prior to winning Ontario for the Liberals after the short-lived Kim Campbell PC government. Dan has never really taken no, or you can't do that, or no one has ever done that before as a reason to not do the right thing. Without knowing his party affiliation, you may be due for some head-scratching if you examine his list of accomplishments. Challenging his own government to do something about the near-monopolist refining industry, being the first MP ever to make an amendment to the criminal code with a private member's bill, which ultimately was sped into law by the Supreme Court. In opposition, taking on the government to have education savings credited like retirement savings, blocking a rapper's entourage from entering Canada because of links to the death of a constituent at that rapper's previous Toronto appearance, and motivated a change to allow Canadian help to buffer the African AIDS epidemic. After 18 years as an MP, Dan helped to found tomorrowsgaspri.com and is often referenced by news sources anytime that the price of gas at our pumps is about to change. He is now the president of Canadians for Affordable Energy and still is on the news regularly to talk about energy and gaswizard.ca. Welcome to Exit 425. It's where we live. My name is Steve Ray, and today's guest is Dan McTague. Dan, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a real honor and a real treat, and looking forward to rocking and rolling here, Steve. Good to see you again.
We have known each other for a long time. You were first elected to the House in 1993, part of the Campbell collapse and the Chrétien crush, and you stayed in office for 18 years. Is the role of the MP the same now as it was in 1993?
Not at all. I mean, members of Parliament are still elected, thankfully, but it's what they do there. And while the routines and roles of members of Parliament have changed over time, perhaps I was there in the golden era when members of Parliament could actually make a difference, speak up, speak out, vote the way they thought, except when it came to matters of confidence. And most importantly, at the end of all of this, be able to move legislation. And I think that's something that we've lost in this era of hyper-partisan politics. But of course, I'm sure that there is always opportunity for things to get back to the way they were. And maybe the pendulum has gone as far as it can in one direction.
What motivated you in the past and what motivates you now?
Well, I think it's the deep desire to try to help people. I've always sort of kept an eye on issues that are most concerned with them, pricing, living amiably one with the other, ensuring that everyone can benefit and prosper from what this country has to offer. It's a nation that is blessed like no other. I worked a little while in foreign affairs and could never have imagined just how blessed we are to live in a country where we have all of these freedoms, the rights, and the prosperity, and the future, a very bright future to go with it. And so a lot of my work has been focused on how to preserve that and be on guard for those who, whether wittingly or unwittingly, are corroding that or compromising that, as we are seeing today.
Does the MP represent the riding to the party, or does it represent the party to the riding? And how has this changed?
That's a very good question. I think in all of this, the role of a member of Parliament once elected is walking a very fine line. I think for any member of Parliament, regardless of pressure by the leader or by the Prime Minister's office to vote and behave in a certain way and to say certain things, most of these things come naturally. Most members of Parliament that I know in my time and the time today will always adhere to what they've campaigned on. If these are specific policies that we enunciated in the federal election for which we were elected for, then you stick to those without deviation. It's what happens on the so many things that we experience and encounter as a country that are not written, in the heat of the moment of an election or pre-election period. Things happen in 2 or 3 years that some may not consider. And so a lot of the work that I did, and I think the role of members of Parliament, how they represent, is you know, being very much a voice for concerns that may be unique to your riding and unique to your area, and bring those to the floor of the House of Commons. That's not to say members of Parliament don't do that and bring petitions forward and whatnot, but I think increasingly we are seeing that members of Parliament, we certainly saw that this week with Liberals voting, you know, unanimously to impose what I thought was an unfairness in terms of no relief for other forms of heating fuel, such as propane and natural gas, as far as being subject to a carbon tax. So I think for many members of Parliament, the idea that it's top down seems to be, you know, the rule of the day, when it should be somewhere in between. You have an obligation to the people you have elected, but those who have elected you have to recognize as well there were conditions and you know, ideas and thoughts and promises that were based on certain things, and that's the way our democracy works. But members of Parliament, I think, need to step up their game, bottom line, because I think the role of the member of Parliament shouldn't be a voting machine for the Prime Minister. The member of Parliament should be a strong voice articulating, you know, curbs and boundaries and looking at legislation, which they may have expertise in offering help to the government when they provide policy that may go awry.
As an MP, and even now, you remain very relatable. Even a very conservative group like the church group that I invited you to speak to, as it turns out, many years ago, they thought that if every MP was like Dan McTagg, things would be better. What did you bring to the role that kept you in office until 2013?
Well, look, I'm not sure what it was in particular. I just thought that you had to work for everybody as a member of Parliament, regardless of whether you happen to understand them or agree with them. Yes, you may have won with 40%, but you represent 100% of the constituents that are there, and that's everybody from every background, from every sense of value, where you can, and as best as you can. You know, I didn't confine my work strictly to those who, you know, believe in certain things that I believed in because I happened to be Roman Catholic. You know, I was, as an example, a member of Parliament who brought the first Eid celebrations to the House of Commons back in 1994. I worked with many people of many faiths on common ideas, and I thought that was really the Canadian way, that we can work to find a common ground. And in fact, it was because of the work I'd done with that community and understanding that helped me a lot in foreign affairs. One of the reasons I wound up leaving energy and consumer issues for a period of time and taking on the role of being charged and tasked with the responsibility for Canadians abroad under the Paul Martin government, and my work afterwards when we were in opposition under the Harper government, was premised on a little bit of better understanding of how you know, Muslim cultures work, as an example. In the same way I would understand my own Christianity, I was surprised that no one had given any thought to a very difficult consular case with William Sampson, and that was the key. It was understanding through Canadians living here, through their faith, how they could best be employed to help save the life of a Canadian abroad. And so I think there's a lot to be learned, a lot of, you know, back and forth. And I think for many people in that period of time, you know, what a great lesson in terms of being able to reach out and listen to people within your own community to solve problems that were of national and international importance at the time.
Just as a side note, back in your day, what was most of an MP's time spent doing? Because I don't think people generally understand that part of it. They only see the House of Commons and maybe a few scrums after or before that sort of event. But what was the majority of an MP's office work all about?
Much of it was just simply helping constituents with federal matters, whether that be, you know, CRA, Revenue Canada issues, whether that be problems with passports, whether that be immigration, whether that be CPP benefits, you know, those who had some issues on policy. Most of your time was spent with people or attending events or responding to letters, and there were many, and trying to provide a personal note to everything you did. in that time, if you could find time, you obviously had obligations to be in Ottawa and to sit on committee and to do your parliamentary duties, which usually involves sitting 3 days a week, a minimum of 3-4 hours a day, and then committee for another 2 hours, 2 to 3 times a week. Sometimes you're on two committees, and then other responsibilities. But I would say the primary preoccupation is and always was, to a large extent, trying to sift through problems for constituents. It helped have good staff, and I had good staff. But I also had one of the largest, most populous ridings in the country, which made my things very challenging because I didn't have the resources. In other words, I had the same parliamentary budget to run my constituency office and Ottawa office to handle constituents for 200,000, a community of 210,000 people, equivalent to, say, a riding in Prince Edward Island of 20,000 people. So it was extraordinarily challenging. And a lot of people that worked with me did so on a voluntary basis. At the same time, you had to find reasons to make sure that you were relevant. Anybody can look at their MP and say, well, that's great, wonderful. What have you done for me lately? I'm not sure it was because of Pickering, Ajax, Whitby, Scarborough East, but there was always an expectation, and I tried to deliver slightly higher returns for their support and for their continued faith in my work. So hopefully, having passed those bills and having changed the course of some of the politics in the country, I did my bit.
And having done some constitutional work with Rennie Suttons, your predecessor in Ontario riding, I remember the size of that riding. It was unwieldy. Of course, it's been split into at least two ridings now. And at the time, a few years before you were in office, we were dealing with 185,000 people in one riding, which, again, as you pointed out, is massive compared to the 4 or 5 Prince Edward Island ridings. So, that was taking on a massive job all in itself. Dan, you spent a lot of time talking about energy and gas prices and how this is affecting Canada. Energy is a key part of the Trudeau platform due to the Prime Minister's passion about correcting climate change. Is the perception that he is wanting to shut down Canada's oil and gas industry justified? And is it the right thing to do if it is?
Well, there's a lot to unparcel with that, but I would say the Prime Minister and certainly his team are hell-bent on shutting down Canada's oil and gas sector. And whether they say it or not is irrelevant. It's how they conducted themselves, blocking pipelines to imposing dozens of regulations aimed at everything from changing the basis on which emissions can be allowed, the willingness to not just have one but two carbon taxes. There's the carbon tax and the clean fuel standard, building code standards, methane standards, just transition. There's a whole raft of policies emanating from what's called the net zero framework. And much of this is stuff that the Prime Minister and his gang have promoted and pushed at international fora and then reimposed on Canadians. And, it would be one thing for me to say these things of Justin Trudeau, but when he surrounds himself with the likes of Stephen Guibeau, a Marxist socialist by his own admission, radical, whose work in a number of organizations go well beyond dangling from buildings in an orange jumpsuit. This is a fellow who has been on a fanatical mission to try to destroy that which has given significant advantage to the world to improve. And I'm not just saying big, heavy oil. Natural gas, the use of nitrogen in fertilizers, to the use of plastics, which is ubiquitous in improving the human condition, in extending life expectancy, of mitigating weather, changes in weather. All of these things, I think, have been completely sidelined by a government that is obsessed with, the idea that an inert gas called carbon dioxide could somehow bring about, significant dramatic changes to the world that we live in. I don't dispute the concern. I think the science is pretty wonky and needs a lot of perspective. But, you know, using the United Nations IPCC's reports and coming out with the most extreme modeling example, which isn't science, to say that's where the world is heading, and then basing your entire political and economic construct on that, I think is extraordinarily disruptive and damaging to the good work that's been done by Canadians to make a cleaner economy, to make a cleaner society. And don't take my word for it. You know, the amount of emissions from vehicles is 20, 30 times less than what it was. We don't have smog days anymore in southern Ontario. We were leaders long before it was cool and trendy to bring about nuclear generation, which you can see in your backyard, for which my riding was proudly the first one complex in North America to use nuclear for commercial purposes in Pickering, and back as early as 1970, 1969, and back to 1966 when the projects began. No, I think the shorter answer to all of this is that I believe Justin Trudeau isn't very bright when it comes to the kind of policies he's advocating, but he sure has a way of imposing them and pushing them to the point where I think, extremely speaking, Canadians can no longer afford to turn the other way. Climate's important, but it doesn't match people who can't make ends meet, can't put food on the table, can't heat their homes, much less pay their mortgage or afford next month's rent.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation about the carbon tax and home heating fuel. Some recent suggested changes by geographic regions has been criticized for not going far enough, and former Environment Minister Catherine McKenna for going the wrong direction. Your specific thoughts about that?
Well, what direction do they want? I mean, these are people who come with very little experience, you know, rub shoulders with the elites of the world and are finding ever more creative ways to say the world is coming to an end as we know it. I don't accept global extremism of a climate crisis or an emergency. I think it's in their minds and it's a made up concept. Yes, we have weather that does change. And yes, we have to find ways to mitigate that. But we all know that, you know, not managing our forests does lead to fire, can lead to fire. Building on floodplains is not a very bright idea because you do get floods from time to time. And yes, we do get hurricanes and we do get the odd, you know, event. Perhaps more because we understand these things, we see these things. But it doesn't mean that the earth is on fire and suddenly that we're going to see this boiling of our oceans. I think it's time for them to stop infusing hyperbole into our policies, because I think it has a lot more destruction of goodwill and intention of people when we see policies that no one can afford. And in this case, pit one region against another. I spoke extraordinarily powerfully to the Atlantic region with two reports by Canadians for Affordable Energy. And you can see them, they're right there. The first and the second one on the Clean Fuel Standard, which the federal government had not done a cost-benefit analysis. Had it done so, it would have quickly acknowledged you can't impose a second tax, much less a first tax, on things like home heating fuel, because in places like Newfoundland, a region of the country where I helped save the refinery back 25 years ago, you can't impose a tax on the only means for which people can remain warm in winters. In 40 to 50% of the instances, they're using stove oil, furnace oil, or heating oil, call it what you will. So if you mess around with that, you drive up the price and you create distortions, market distortions, expect that there is going to be backlash. The problem is that it creates inequality. And we cannot have uneven policies cut out cookie made for certain constituencies because we happen to notice in the past 4 months our numbers there are dwindling. I said in a tweet on June 19th, that the federal government's imposition of the Clean Fuel Standard and the carbon tax would trigger a backlash on a scale which very few saw coming and which was going to affect the Liberals. If that's how we do our policies in this country, based on politics and polling, then I think people like Catherine McKenna's and others had best be very wary of what they're advocating, because it may work in their own echo chamber, but in the rest of the world, they can't possibly discuss these matters with a grain of salt and integrity when it comes to realism. The reality is that what they're proposing is neither a solution nor is it a long-term response to a problem of their own making.
Could a stronger oil and gas industry in Canada strengthen Ukraine's situation?
Look, I'm not a big fan of the oil industry. They're not big fans of mine. We've been enemies for many years. Enemies because they lose $30, $40, $50 million a year with my gas price predictions, which I pioneered back in the 1990s. Glad to see others are on that. But in all of that discussion, you will not find the integrity, the honesty to talk about green policies that are in damaging and distorting markets. Canada had an opportunity to be able to be a solution to the world. When the Prime Minister of Japan or the Chancellor of Germany come knocking on your door and visit you and say, can you please provide us some oil and natural gas? You are, after all, a country that has the third largest provable reserves of the first and fifth largest of the second. Perhaps you ought to consider, for your own economic benefit, but for the purposes of geopolitical stability and security, that Canada can indeed play a role. And you're not like the other two that are ahead of us, Venezuela and Saudi Arabia, or the two after us, which happen to be Iran and Iraq. Look, we are only doing it to ourselves as Canadians when we tend to think that we can, by killing pipelines and burying ourselves and isolating ourselves and, you know, and making ourselves immune from what is happening around the world, that we can somehow avoid the pitfalls. Canada has an abundance of resources managed well as it is to the highest levels of any nation in the world on the so-called ESG woke ranking. If we don't provide these things to the world, and other countries like Russia, with the eighth largest provable reserves, are able to play with our economy and to play with regions of the country that are, well, looking right now at recession. Think of Germany. Put all its eggs in one basket under the policy of Enerwind. That Enerwind policy basically says we'll get our natural gas from them and we'll just go wind and solar. Well, what country now has had to reopen, knock down some of their windmills and near Dusseldorf and begin to expand what once was moribund lignite coal mining, is now expanding those to make room for a need to ensure that its country doesn't run out of energy. What country is borrowing massively from the United States, which had zero LNG projects 12 years ago when Canada had 17 on the books, which now has seven of them built, saving the world, helping the world, making lots of money in the process, while Canada sits there like the international Boy Scouts, whining about the fact that the rest of the world is passing them by. All this sounds highly political and motivational in terms of why I'm doing these. What bothers me more than anything else, though, Steve, is that Canada is an opportunity for the world. It's also an opportunity for itself. We've kissed away tens of billions of dollars of revenue that could go to pay for our hospitals, that could pay for our social infrastructure so that we continue to maintain a high standard of living and be the beacon of envy of the world. But no, we've chosen the woke idea that somehow, and let me make this math very clear, having 0.04% concentration of carbon in the air, of which humankind is responsible for 3%, of which Canada is responsible for 1.5%, is mathematically insane. It would be like saying we have to clean up all of Niagara Falls because we found a grain of salt in it over the past day. It's not even worth considering. And for people to erect policies and look at you in the face and pretend that they're being serious about these things, I think they need a good number of them need to really have a very careful look, not only at the math, but at how unrational some of these people really are.
And that answers another question that I had for you about, the significance relative to the cost of Canada going totally green, right? And ideally the way that perhaps Stephen Guilbeault would wish us to be without any oil and natural gas or coal being burned anywhere, and just what sort of global contribution that would make. So I appreciate you addressing that as well. Dan, before we actually started recording this interview, I found out some things about you that I didn't know, and that you grew up in the eastern part of Oshawa, very close to exit 425, and that's pretty cool. So that helps to inform this question in terms of This podcast was started as a something for a community on the edge, on the eastern frontier of the GTHA. When you were an MP, you represented an area, and I remember because I was teaching over there, an area that was at the peak of its explosion as a frontier community in Pickering and Ajax, that whole area. Any advice for the people and politicians of Eastern Durham and Clarington, especially now that I know that you know this area?
Well, look, by accident, 347 Grandview, and we were literally the extreme part of Oshawa. There, nothing went behind me. It was the old golf course, and all of stopped at Grandview at the time. Look, the demographics, which lean to the, you know, the newest areas within the urban parts of this country, are indeed the you know, the trendsetters, the pace setters for what Canada will become. How communities function, how they address problems, how they innovate, and how they provide creative responses to everyday challenges really is a hallmark of the kind of communities that will be very much part of what Canada looks like in the next 20 to 30 years. So I think proximity, especially at exit 425, has a lot to do with being on the leading edge of the Canada of the future. And so, you know, be proud of that and understand that you have a higher role than simply the older parts of the city. It's not to disparage or take away from those, but there's something very wonderful and unique and invigorating about being on the frontier of where urban Canada meets rural Canada, and where the Canada of the future is right in front of us and we're part of.
I'm excited and hoping that our community engagement can help our community get it right for many years going forward. So I appreciate that. A few rapid fire thoughts about leaders currently in the news, and we'll start with Danielle Smith.
What a wonderful premier. Stands up for her province, has basically not given into the old tried and true of being demonized by the left. She's certainly made her community proud, and I think to a large extent, you know, helping us on the energy front as well, reminding people that the plan by the Trudeau-Guibault government of trying to electrify everything isn't just impractical financially. It's likely to lead to significant harm to Canadians. So although she's Premier of Alberta, she's actually speaking for a lot of us here in Ontario.
Pierre Poilievre.
Well, there's a fellow who knows how to debate. I think is getting stronger by the day. I knew him as a younger MP. I did spar with him a couple of times. He's tough. He's good. He's fair. But he's very effective. And he sticks to his program of trying to get the country back on its feet again, and end the divisiveness that has been very much a part of the Trudeau period. I think he will do extraordinarily well, and regardless of what the polls are saying, I think he's the genuine article. As a Liberal, I think it's pretty clear that he's going to be around for quite some time.
Justin Trudeau.
Well, there's a guy who I believe, you know, had a name, and the name itself sold, and perhaps his style was right, you know, for a period of time. But I think the country needs serious leadership. The socks, sobbing, and selfies is not a way to run the country. I think he has amassed more in a very brief period of time as a member of parliament in terms of scandal and concern and economic downturn on a scale that has had few equals. Politely, I think it's time for him to pack up and go, and I'm being very polite. The longer he stays, the more damage he's going to do to the Federation, and the longer it's going to take to fix.
Dan, you're always known for being relatable and a very high level of candor, and I appreciate your remarks. Thank you so much. Your thoughts and insights are greatly appreciated. I hope I can tap you again for a future conversation about government, politics, and civic involvement. What is the best way for people to reach out to you?
Yeah, just president at affordableenergy.ca. You can always show up on Twitter from time to time. Join me there, Gas Price Wizard. And looking forward to definitely being here more often and more frequently with you, Steve Ray, here at Exit 425.
That's awesome. And I can attest to the fact that some of the engagements you have on Twitter are very entertaining and very thoughtful. So
we'll keep up the entertainment side of it if we can.
It's always interesting. So that's awesome. To all who are listening, thank you for listening to this episode of Exit 425. We have our fans everywhere. Please like and subscribe on whatever platform you use. And our mission is to provide substantial information and education that goes where you want. Of course, Exit 425 is where we live. Exit 425 is a production of Studio 38 Audio, copyright 2023. My name is Steve Ray. If you have questions or would like more information about Exit 425, join our Exit 425 Facebook group. Check out Instagram, LinkedIn, and of course now YouTube. You can email me at exit425401@gmail.com.